This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest this season, new season, is John Rubicki, who's come from Detroit, and he's come just to read you this opening poem.
Julianne in the Bone Marrow Unit, Zion, Illinois. Aw, dame, I don't know how else to love you, so I just start juggling. I'm on the street three floors below your hospital room, lofting fish or birds that graze against my hands and fly off. I'm juggling cancer cells and carnations, slipping in the bowling pin we snuck out of that alley in Maine. Then I'm juggling freight trains and angels and elephants, dropping them all. I don't care. So long as you stand near your high window and laugh. So long as you stand near your hospital bed, clapping your hands.
That's the voice of John Rubicki. And here he is. He's an associate professor of English and writer in residence at ALMA. He also teaches creative writing through Wings of Hope Hospice to children who have been through trauma or loss. He sometimes works in a paint factory, a tire shop in Kalamazoo. He lives in Delton, Michigan with his son now. The book I'm holding in my hand is We Bed Down Into Water. And of all the books I've read this year, this one is one that has nailed me, riveted me to one place so that I will never, ever be without this book again. John, why don't you just tell us what is in this book?
Well, I tend to not write when I'm a balanced, even-keeled sort of guy, but when there's some sort of duress of spirit, earthquake weather of the heart, I start dunking my pen in a stream that's burning. My wife had cancer 7 times, 2 bone marrow transplants. One of the blessings of illness is that it magnifies the moment and gets you savoring with abandon every living breath. Am I to give thanks for human suffering when out of it springs my most incendiary song? I don't know. But my wife's illness and loving her along that precipice where I could lose her at any moment did get the rivers of fire moving through me to the page.
How long were you together?
20 years.
Let's hear another poem. This is John Rubicki.
Me and my lass, we are a poem. We tangle our hair in the moon. Then she coughs, and I have no net to catch the cough, so I make her warm tea with honey. I call her my coughing alarm clock, but she's warmer and smoother than our oven for waltzing with. When we travel in our covered wagon, she's in the bathtub, splashing her way across the prairie, singing Bo Diddley songs. Any drops she spills, the prairie dogs lick them up. That's the kind of poem she is. When we lie down in the earth, we'll need coffins with holes bored through their sides. We'll each have one arm hanging out so I can take hold of her hand even while I'm in the dirt. Some nights our bed floats through the bedroom walls. We're on our bellies laughing and rowing with one arm. When we get tired, the stars make nice pillows for our heads. The wind is what wakes me. Blowing so hard, I watch my love's skin flake off. A whole storm of her flutters away from me until all that's left inside her is a tired old woman holding her spine like a candle.
Love that line. Did you know you used that line in another poem?
Yes, I do.
I thought, now there is a brave man. He has enough faith in that line. John Rubicki has had 4 books. One, the one we're talking about, We Bed Down Into Water. Before that, 3 Lanterns. And is that the one that's in the Best American Poetry of 2008?
Yeah, that poem was selected by Charles Wright.
How did that happen?
And actually, since we're vibing on my wife, when we cracked open the envelope and found out that
she was there.
She was there, and she started doing this dance in place and high five and both hands, and she was, you know, dude. She calls me dude, and I call her dame, and she's high fiving me, and she missed with one of her high fives and smacked me right in the nose.
Which woke you up to reality.
Yeah.
But that is very impressive. That's real impressive. And how did he come across that poem?
It appeared in Plowshares, and just by grace, he flipped to the poem.
And it's pretty hard to get to Plowshares these days, I'll tell you. They are backed up. That's John Rybicki, and his former book was Yellow-Haired Girl with Spider, then Traveling at High Speeds. And there might be another one on the way, right?
Yeah.
A new one coming.
Yeah.
Well, we're at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're going to hear more from John.
Our romance. I'm beside my father at a red light, an altar in Kirchville as a boy. My booze lamp pops, saying, "You couldn't kill someone if you had to." To a son, axed in half by tenderness. Pops, who bare-knuckle brawls with his grown boy to punch breathing holes through my armor and love me through them. Who welts my arm and jaw with blows as I do my Sugar Ray duck and weave and spring in under his oak fists, cup my hand around his cheek, and stop everything. See, he is trying to hold his son with blows. He snaps a straight jab, whips a right, then left hook. It looks like he's trying to wrap his boy tenderly up, if you could only see it in slow motion. Pops, who half headlocks his son after, laughing as if someone is using a rough knife to carve the sounds out of him. "I'd kick your ass in a fight," he says. "You want to know why? Why? I want to know why. Because you won't hit your old man, but your old man will hit you." Pops, who has a knife wound slash like a strap from his shoulder to his opposite hip, who gave up drinking to throw iron and swim laps. He flexes his gladiator chest in our living room, his boys on either side cupping their hands around his rock biceps, tracing their hands along his sloping lats. Pops, who used to hand me his coat when he got home and then sucker punch me in the gut. "We're going into the yard. I've got to kick your ass before you get any bigger. Patsy, I'm taking Johnny into the yard to kick his ass." Laughing, throwing his arm around my neck. "Only you better watch out. I fight dirty." Pops, whose ma died when he was 6 months old, who danced on barroom tables to get money to go to St. Joe's. Danced until his dad's cigarette-toothed friends sprinkled coins at his feet. Until one day in the alley near the kitchen door, old Lady Bernardini shouted back into the bar, "Francis, it's that Rybicki boy, here to beg again." I'm back home and he's loving me. I mean, really loving me. Staggering from the garage to the kitchen with his arm around my neck, when he turns like a man on a wedding cake and slaps me in the face. "Slap me back again," he says, his light blue eyes beaming. "It's so good to see my boy." We're face to face. I can't hit what I love. He smacks me again, not too hard, but hard enough. I slap him back. "Come on harder," he says, and whacks me one full in the face, something like tenderness breaking open in him. "Come on," Pop says, "I want to feel alive."
That's John Rybicki. John, how many kinds of love have you known? That's a tough, I mean, that was an unusual kind of love, right? The headlock, the punch in the gut. And then you had Julie. Do you think you've known it all? Have you felt it all?
No, I still feel like there's a leaf's going to fall off the tree, a tree somewhere, and slap against my face, and that'll be a new kind of love. Seeing a fellow passenger to the grave, as Dickens puts it. All humankind, I love to splash around and collide with any human spirit I meet. I mean, the body is a great hiding place, and we pass by each other in, you know, relative anonymity, and you can glean certain things from the way people attire themselves. But especially in teaching creative writing, I tell my students, you know, in the context of the heavens and the earth, we're, you're infinitesimal, tiny bits of nothingness, but as spiritual beings, we're vast beyond naming. You'd need a tape measure made of light to measure the spiritual dimensions of every one of us.
But they look at your work and they must say, "Well, how do you do it?" Because your work is so varied, and it's so vast, and it's so risky, and it tries so many things. It must be a little bit off-putting to them. They must say, "Oh, I can't do this," or, "Don't you teach your own work?" I never teach my own work.
Well, it's interesting because I do teach DARE more than I teach creative writing. I dare students to shed skins and become possible through the language. I don't want us to set about the business of, you know, evolving a little bit as wordsmiths. I want the trajectory to be one of, let's make our assault on the heavens.
Do they do it?
They do it. I'll say, I want you to rip a tree trunk out by its roots, dunk it in a star's fire, and scrawl across the sky the kinds of sentences God might roll out of bed and read. And they have, and they do.
That's your curriculum.
That's it.
I like it. And I heard that they all stood up as one and went to the provost and said, we want him back. Because you were a poet in residence for a year, associate professor. But this is like, we were saying, itinerant workers, to be in residence as a poet. And you said you'd like to hang your hat somewhere.
I'd love to hang my hobo shoes by one peg on the wall. I already feel like, you know, it's been cool teaching in inner city Detroit kids. One of my eighth grade boys, you know, I want a heart that when it pumps, all the bullets fly out of all the guns and turn to dust.
Oh.
In the real world, physiologically, he couldn't eradicate gun violence, but on the page where anything is possible, this boy becomes a potentate. He heals the world's wounds with language. And when I'm teaching inner city kids or I'm teaching college kids, I dare them to unlearn moon, star, you know, any benign object can become a potent object in a writer's sensibility.
Tell us about, you have a few samples. Now, one thing about you is that you don't read, you recite poetry. And you incorporate it and you memorize it. And this is part of your DNA, I think. So you said that you knew by heart some of your kids' poetry. Is this from the hospice where you work?
Some from hospice, quite a few from the inner city kids in Detroit.
Give us a taste.
All right, well, this is a poem written by Cameron Penny, and I heard it recited at the Marie Howe recited it at the Dodge Poetry Festival to a good 5,000 people, and everyone in the midst of this poem exhaled as one human family. I heard Robert Bly talk about poetry being the language of disruption, and it really is. If you could see inside my father not a suit of armor, but shock waves of armor that were kind of, permeate his being, because all of us bump into human suffering wearing the skin. Thou knowest the first time we breathe the air, we wail and cry. So how can a poet with their paltry human breath aim their small poetic wind at all that armor that crews at us to rake away that veil of sleep that mounts in us until the trumpet blasts of chills are shooting through the skin. We're breathing a sweeter sort of oxygen.
Bill said you talk just like you write. It is so true. Our common friend Bill Palmer, this is true. You do talk just like you write. There's no difference. Just a page between you. Give us something that the kids wrote.
Okay, this is Cameron Penny. If you are lucky in this life, a window will appear between two armies on a battlefield. Instead of seeing their enemies in the window, the soldiers see themselves as children. They stop fighting and go home and sleep. When they wake up, the land is well again.
Do you know how that was triggered?
And prophetically, I did the residency at my old alma mater, St. Clair Montefalco, the week before 9/11. I asked the kids, where are some of the world's biggest problems? Pollution, gun violence, war, et cetera. And then I said, all right, well, what can we do? Let's pick some objects, benign objects from the ordinary world, and see if we can fix those problems. And I put some words on the board like feather, wind. How could a feather eradicate homelessness? Well, you ask a fourth grader, the feather can fly up to a tree and start drawing, apples on the branches, and winter scarves and hats can sprout from the branches, and the feather can tickle the branch until the winter coat falls off and lights on the homeless man's hands. And all of a sudden, they become larger than themselves through the reimagining the world. So I just happened to put window on the board, and he picked war, and
How old was he?
Fourth grade, so...
Fourth grade, 9 years old. Yeah. And of your own son, this is a story that you should share. You adopted a son 5 years ago?
5 years.
And when Julie was still well?
Right.
And what was the process for that? How did you go into that? What did you wind up with? What were the surprises?
Well, during the school year, I'd approach Pelham Magnet Middle School in Detroit, and the kids would hang their honey jar miles out the window, and they'd be like, Mr. Rybicki's in the house. And they'd cry out to me, and they'd sing to me. They'd sing my name, so I had to wear my name. I'm a cuckoo poet, and, you know, I have a line in one of my poems where the pictures on our driver's license should be liquid and ever-changing. Having the continuity of working with the same kids over the year, splashing around in their light, tending their becoming, that kept me going. But when summer hit, I wanted to be a papa so bad. And each summer, when all the kids weren't jangling around me and pouring holy water over my head, a huge hole kind of gaped open in me, and I longed to we tried everything we could in between Julie's relapses to have a child, and it didn't work out. So at the end of this one year, I found this boy staggering through the halls with everyone in class, and he had been a student of mine, and really an incendiary seer. And tears were just shooting out of his eyes, and I put my arm around him, and I said, let's take a walk. And
how old is he?
Now?
No, when did this happen?
He was 12. He was 12, and he had some friction with a couple boys, and it just a kind of light went off on me. I was toying with the idea of joining Big Brothers Big Sisters. His mom worked at the school. I had run down the hallway when he hatched a new poem, carrying the sacred text to his mom, and she, you know, tears would fall, and just to see her son's, you know, fire being tended. And so I broached the subject with her, and could I be his big brother this summer? And she said it would be a prayer answered. And we started meeting once a week, throwing the football, you know, taking a ride on my dad's boat. At the end of the summer, we took him to Cedar Point, my brother Benny and I. And when we got home, literally his house had been shot up in a drive-by shooting that day. Glass shatter everywhere. You could put your fingers into the bullet holes in the walls. We're crying through one of the busted windows for his mom, and it just echo chambered through the house. And through that sort of diabolical providence, he came to be my son.
And now he's 18.
Yeah, he's 18.
An African-American child, two white parents. Was there anything unusual about that?
Not for me, you know, let a man, I mean, if anything, it made me, it sweetened the pot for me. I got a lot of city boy in me, a lot of brash, and, you know, my tongue will slip into an East Side sort of dialect now and then. And
you called him a soldier. What does that mean? A child soldier.
Yeah, he only met his father once in his life. You know, he tripped along streets where he was walking over broken glass and bullet casings. He'd seen it all.
At 12 years old. But life is different now because he can be a poet full time with Papa, right?
Yeah.
Oh boy, I'd like to see what he writes. This is John Rybicki. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. We're entering John's life, and it's quite a ride. So we'd like some more poetry.
I'm actually going to read two short poems in sequence, if that's possible. This is Fire Psalm, and it's one of those poems that I wrote and then dropped down to my knees when I was done and waited for the heavens to open up and start tossing lightning bolts at my head. But Fire Psalm. Alexander the Great, Genghis Khan, and all the little unknown assassins who dunk their mouths into holy water, drunk and bobbing at the bottom for, you know what, babies' heads, not apples. I know a tree askew where children dangle by those oh-so-slender umbilical cords, feeding light into their heads. God, if I were only just blood, an animal governed by appetite and piss, I'd go back to my hands around my own neck, legs like broken timepieces dangling below that stem. I know a tree where you can snap a child off by his head and bite into his skin and lift the shiny side after, lift it way up over your head. Here you go, God, you light junkie. Bite into this.
I love that.
And Fire Psalm Revisited, since it's a short one.
John Rybicki's here. What is there about your poetry, which is lyrical, but yet is not strictly narrative? It's out of narrative. You still tell story. How do you describe your particular genre, because it is not narrative poetry, except that prose poem about your father. And looking at the pattern on the page is where I get the meter. So how do you describe, if somebody says, how do you characterize your poetry? Are you a lyric poet? What do you say?
Well, I'd like to be sort of blind about exactly what I'm doing. I do know that I love a linguistic dance that's saturated in acoustical nuance. How much sound repetition can the sentence bear? How much acoustical honey can drip from the lines onto the listener's tongue without becoming self-conscious?
Mm-hmm.
I have a great penchant for transformation. There's a essay, and I haven't really lapped it up since I was in my teen years, but Emerson wrote about traveling, and he said, I went to Rome and to Greece and sought to be intoxicated by sights and sounds, but I was not intoxicated. My giant followed me wherever I went. And from the moment I read that, it was an answer. It was became a talisman of power for me. In the real world, when my wife's in the bone marrow unit, and her, no one prepared me for the Colt in her chest kicking 135 beats a minute. And, you know, love makes you, gives you these feeling like you have these radical healing powers, but you're locked on the outside of someone's body. So I'm rubbing her wrist in slow concentric circles. I love to lull the heart rate down to 127, 124, 119. After about an hour, I'm nail just grazing her arm, rubbing her bald head, 114, 111, 109. Once I lulled her heart rate down to 99 beats, but you know, it's an hour and a half into this and I gotta pee. I got to get up and leave the bone marrow unit, and I got to rip off my surgeon's garb and re-scrub before I go in again, and again, the Colt's kicking in her chest. In the literal world, there's minuscule things I could do. In a poem, my giant can hoist into the air freight trains and angels and elephants.
And you put that rhythm into your poem. But what I want the audience to know is that you talk in these marvelous meteors. Your words are like galactic words. But when you look at it on the page, it is extremely well disciplined. You are the aesthetic of the space on the page. The placement of line is so polished, so exquisite. It is of a higher tone. And you know that, John. You know that you're not just going from margin to margin.
I do tell my students, you rupture in the initial draft, and everyone works differently, but I opt for speed of hand in a first draft. With volition comes surprise. But then you set about with hammer and chisel, revising, sparks flying up into your eyes to give birth to a nuanced and acoustic.
But can they get that? I mean, I met the kids at Alma. First of all, I love that fresh Midwestern cherry-cheeked look. It's nothing like I've ever seen before in any other college. And I presented some pretty far-out exercises, and they did get it. But can they really reach what you're trying to hold out to them?
Oh, every single kid that I teach, I believe, has greatness in them. You know, when you see the figure skater at the Olympics do her third and second and third twirl into the air, she for a moment tugs all humankind into the heavens, trumps gravity, and we're craning forward. Will she do it? Will she land the triple axel or whatever it's called? And for that millisecond, she exalts all humankind. You don't see that gal falling on her can, sitting at home with ice packs on her fanny, on her arms, on her elbows. Grace comes hard and slow in this life.
Well said. Well said. Exactly right.
Yeah, so it's through maniacal devotion to craft. And I'll tell them this. You have no more grandeur, no more eloquence in your being than a factory worker in Detroit, a Buddhist monk, a teacher in Japan, who, let's say, is dealing with someone close to them that's ill. What you have as the poet is you've been singularly devoted to something, and you become the great translator for all humankind.
Oh, that's great. That is so great. I did get them to meditate, so I knew that these corn-fed kids were very available, because Bill said, go ahead, Grace, try everything. And we went into a deep meditation before we worked, and they were so ready. There was not any snickering, no sneering. They humored me, but it is a great college. I love it a lot. This is The Poet and the Poem. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest is John Rybicki, and we'll be right back. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest is John Rybicki. We're at the Library of Congress, and we're going to hear more from John.
Fire Psalm Revisited. Lord, tilt your lamps so the oil flows up out of man. Take away this relentless burning. Let your stars sip on my fire like tea. Take the scalding light back into heaven, where bodies are built for such things.
Is there anything about language that we cannot own and use? Is there anything not available to us? You seem to think that words are just made for you.
I do, but there are times when, if I'm sitting across from someone I love, there's an intimacy and an eloquence, a higher language is passing between us.
And so it channels.
Oh, and I'll say to my beloved, I'd need Mozart, you know, standing in my body, Shakespeare's power to translate the grandeur of this. You know, so we fail lavishly in our attempts to pull off those transcendent moments on the page. But every now and then, some embers of the divine will spawn through your pen to the page, and you'll get it right, and it's worth every breath.
John, was there ever a greater love than that between you and Julie?
I'd say it rivals the great loves in human history. She has a quote from one of our, that I start off the physics poem in my collection, where she says, even our skeletons are in love. My gal would sit in the bathtub. She'd take old sitcom tunes like the theme song from MASH, and she'd be splashing in the tub singing, I-L-O-V, my D-U-D. She called me dude, and I called her dame, and she'd splash in the tub. And then back at home, with the steam on the bathroom window, you could hear her squeegee her love notes to me in the steam. And I told my boy after Julie died, I went up to the glass, put my breath on the glass, fogged it up again, and you could still see her last love note to us.
He lived with her for 5 years. So how is it for him?
He feels like he owes not his whole life to her, but that all that we both have to do good in the world now just to do honor by the gift that she gave us.
John Rybicki, let's have a poem.
All right. This is long before this tenderness between us was born, and you'll have to imagine I have daughters, which I don't. Whitman knew he was a drop of light that fell, splashing against the mud, and landed upright a man, sprouting calves and hips, the sweet fruit already ringing in his chest. Imagine the orchestra of drops pouring from God's face, long before the throat became a smokestack. Long before this tenderness between us was born, there was a mouth rising from the ground to pool like some birdbath under you, a drum where your navel sits, and a hut whose walls were bathed in lamplight. Tonight you listen to our daughter sleep. You flick her bedroom light off because it's the one hard star you are in charge of. You lean in the doorway, pouring your blood up to our daughter's throat, where it sits like some blanket you keep, even though she lives on the outside of you now.
You use a lot of phrases and partial sentences. When you dismantle the line, it's odd. It's kind of a mirage. You actually get a larger whole. Do you want to talk about that a little bit? How pulling the line apart makes for a more entire thought? Because that's kind of magic, isn't it? You do it.
Bless
you. You do know you do it, right?
I'd say
maybe I better not tell you. You might not be able to do it anymore.
Well, I, I,
You know what I mean by phraseology, space, and then all of a sudden entirety.
Right. And you know, how do we address this white space issue when fiction writers are clamoring to get a deluge of their words into a magazine, and we're carving out this white space. I like to think of the beginning of the poetic line as silence broken, the end of the poetic line as silence restored. The white space is the hands of God pressing in on the language. So you have a language of distillation, compression. Poetry at its best is prayer. And of course, you know, with line ends, you can create that sort of precipice where you interrupt the sentence in a timely fashion. So it takes the eye a millisecond to flicker down to the next line and you get a duality of meaning. But yeah, I tell my students, and this is something I learned from Gordon Lish, everything resides in the inaugural sentence. You have silence broken, a cadence of language is established, and you must be at the height of your power.
That's
in the inaugural sentence.
I see it.
Don't, I'm dying too fast. Don't talk your way to power. I'm dying too fast to journey seven stanzas down into a poem before you, you know, the plumage of an image or some blinding sparks are
the
tossed
the plumage
in
of
eyes.
An image. Oh, John, let's hear a poem.
Okay, this is St. Clair of Montefalco, where I was an altar boy and a troublemaker, and mischief was my life. But I really was burning. I had this soprano voice through the fourth grade, and I was burning to be in the choir, but my repute as a bad dog, you know, had reached Sister Corinne's ears, and she wouldn't let me in. So this is St. Clair of Montefalco. Sister Corinne had been warned not to let the flame-haired boy into her choir. I had a tie up tight against my throat and this glass-cracking voice. Man, I wanted to sing. Mrs. Kellett kept warning that slender nun off. I sat in front by choice after that, something a mischief-sniffing kid like me would never have done. I sat in front in music class and blasted that soprano right into the gut of my bad rep. Sister Corinne could not sit still in her white fatigues. Could not bear to hear this sweet bird out there and not throw her white shawl around him, not add his voice to the heavenly liftoff that went on behind the altar on Sundays. After 6 weeks of this, Sister Corinne could bear no more and kept me in after class. I bowed, she smiled. This was the fourth grade. I lasted 5 glorious weeks before I got the boot, before I reclaimed my seat mixed up with the other bad boys in the back of that room. But I want you to know there was a time when I floated out over the front of the altar in my altar boy smock, and I've been a sinner ever since.
You know, little did she know that you, of all, would be the one to do God's work, that you would go out and empower millions of young people to bring God through them. And God's fingerprints are all over you, John. You're just lousy with them.
Bless you.
And you were into Orthodoxy, Catholicism, and then you, like all of us, probably read everything else. And now you said since Julie's death, you feel like you need that anchor.
Yeah, I've been crawling back into church on Sundays and where, you know, I want the pews to break like waves against the altar. I have a couple hundred thousand fists raised inside me towards the heavens, but I got to breathe the same oxygen as one of the most exquisite lasses this earth has ever seen. There's more between heaven and earth than I dreamt of in your philosophies, Horatio, and I hope he can take the heat when I'm swinging my fists at the sky. And
the book is We Bed Down Into Water, and I think everyone should get it, don't you? Who's the publisher?
Northwestern University Press.
Northwestern University Press. You just go into a bookstore and tell them to order it. We Bed Down Into Water, because most little bookstores don't carry a lot of poetry. But if you ask for it, they'll feel they need it, and they'll feel that it's in demand. So go to every bookstore and ask for it. We Bed Down Into Water, and you'll hear one of the greatest love stories ever told, and you'll see it in some of the most exquisitely pared-down words I've read this year. John, read us another poem.
Bulrushes. My wife and I in the dark, and she's kissing my palm. I ease it around to the tumors on the back of her neck, fat tulip bulbs and cradle her down. Tomorrow I will lay my hand against our blacktop street, turn it into river. A child in a basket will come floating, and I'll rush out midstream to get her.
I want the audience to know that you never looked down at the page when you said that poem. And if I wonder how you can commit it to memory, it's because of the vowels. It is. Okay. We're at the Library of Congress. I should tell people who are just walking through their kitchen.
Okay, this is a kind of a tribute poem. It's not in the collection. It's a tribute poem to all women who offer their balm to this sore planet and temper the male beast. This is called Tender Range. Come the white morning, I'll cross the earth on my face. Let the barrel of light tip over one more time, and let's just call it sunrise. I don't know anything about blowing a child out like a balloon, or the life that comes after. That dream, a waterfall sealed in a flask close to God's hip. It's night now, with those squares of light all over the world. A woman has been spreading her own fire onto the windows of her house, just like I have rubbed oil onto your belly. Mothers daub their own light to the glass, so even a scarecrow like me out wandering the night can take his chin out from inside his coat where his own lantern is hissing. To gaze in the glass and stop the crunch of footfalls over the bones of things I cannot fix. Do you know how many hobos like me are out there where the wind howls? We lift our sore eyes to where her fire pours over the snow, because we know she is in there doing her soft work.
I was thinking about the history of the woman's image in literature, and how the male has written about the woman in the past. And as we know, it was always idealized. And this is so different. This is so different because it is not romanticized. You're sort of saying, you are the part of the earth that we need. It was a prayer, wasn't it? A prayer to women.
And for that matter, I'd say the genesis of that poem. I mean, every night walk I've taken since I lived on a dairy farm in grad school, and I saw that balmy golden light pouring out onto the snow, and it felt as if it wasn't lamplight. I know rationally, you know, there's a light on in the house, but it felt like a woman inside had parted back one rib, and this light was spilling from her body.
Have you written that yet?
No.
That line, that has to go. That has to. We'll do it back on the car. You have to write that line about pulling her rib back.
Okay.
Yeah. And continue that thought. I'm sorry.
And the light, you know, it's a savage world, you know. it's just, thou knowest the first time we breathe the air, we wail and cry. I say it again. And there's just something about the light that pours from a woman that just...
What of your own mother?
My dad was a pretty hard drinking dog back in the day, and owned a bar restaurant in inner city Detroit, and he could be a pretty frisky, frightening beast some nights. And my mom would meanwhile be in the kitchen singing some old Sinatra song, standing in the steam of a pot and just lacing the walls with tenderness.
Have you written that yet?
No.
Okay, you have your assignment. John Rabicki, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and we are loving it because I've read his work. I never met him before. Then through the largesse of Alma College, they said, we will pay your way to Washington, D.C. to be on The Poet and the Poem. And I cannot say enough good things about that college. Read us a poem, and let's dedicate it to them.
Okay. This is called The Story. Someone floats through your middle with a spine like a candle, a nightgown over it, and you see through the simple talk, the blood bell gone again like fading action, the slug you moment in a story, then after, when the body hums warm and electric with what it can't hold on to. Let's say the very action of living, heart and lungs, is a printing press of selves.
Mm.
If you are lucky, flashing, maybe millions of the selves who love the girl coalesce, recline at night and lie down in her circle, your circle still opening for her. Some nights you blink to find her mouth biting through the same pear, that sweet opening, that new flavored kiss. If you are lucky, you press on with the same wobbly shopping cart, the two of you pushed out of Egypt or ancient Rome, pushed out of sparking glaciers when the body first filled with such a frightening thunder. And when the curtain darkens to blood, the old wooden porches with their swings rock as if the wind were kicking its legs. Are you aware? Each day, one more hanky gets tugged up from the blood house, and you are one day less in this hard Eden.
With what it cannot hold. And where that poem turns is, are you aware? So that even in your passion, you're the craftsman. You know where to turn the corner in the poem, which I think is very important for people to know, that it is not just an outpouring of the heart. It's how to take a breath, how the poem has to breathe before it can be a great poem. And if you want to know what a miracle really is, John, it is that why I believe this, that eternity is just like this long satin ribbon and we're just this little knot on it. Because think of the poems about love and death. What themes are more stated more often? And yours say it in a way I've never heard before. Now, I want to say something about that. That's not a new thought, but how many people have talked about love and death? And yet there's still ways to say it in the inimitable voice. What do you say about that?
Well, and that's the challenge to, you know, the students, some of my students are pre-meds, you know, I had a couple, you know, the kids are on the football team, pre-med students, and I come in daring them to become possible through the language and, you know, dunk your pen in a stream that's burning. And, you know, they'll come up to me after class scared. And I say, well, look, if you think of each person as a kind of set of chimes that what are those chimes that you can see through those, that glass that the light shines through, prisms. The way the light shines through each of us is, you know, in all our particularity of difference, mm-hmm. as Jack Gilbert writes, but they have it in them, and it's just a matter of being willing to, when I teach, I'll lift my palm into the air and I'll say, you're the bird that's going to take flight from this palm, and you're going to crash and break some wings, but then we're going to tape the wing together again, and you're going to keep making your attempt to be that great translator.
The great translator, that's a phrase I really like a lot that you've just given me, the great translator. That's all we are, right?
Every once in a while.
John Rybicki, he's here at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're having our best conversation. Have you ever taught the great John Donne, the great Milton? Have you ever had a chance to teach that kind of literature?
Very little. I mean, I did do a intro to poetry course at Alma this year where it's an overview of the great arc of poetry through human history. So you can put a little taste of
it. But you seem
to
be inspired and very much inflamed by the metaphysical poets.
Oh, yeah.
You're in that tradition.
Yeah. I love the story about Milton actually when he was going blind reciting his poems to his daughters and having them transcribe, and he's like, there are plant eyes that I may sing of things invisible to human sight.
We should be blind so that we are capable of vision, Pound said. Well, I like the story of Milton visiting Galileo, both blind.
Wow.
Even that's as good a conversation as Rybicki and Cavalieri, almost, probably. Not really.
They're rolling out of bed and blowing us kisses right now.
Let's have a poem. That's what we're here for, and the book is We Bed Down Into Water. He's won many awards. He's been poet in residence at several colleges, mostly Michigan, right?
Yeah.
Kalamazoo, Olivet, keynote speaker, guest lecturer, festival judge. You were at the Dodge Festival. Would you say you're in the mainstream of poetry? Nobody ever feels that they are.
No, I feel like I'm hidden, but you know, every now and then I'm surprised that someone will, you know, throw a hunk of coal across the earth and it'll land in my yard, and there'll be a love note attached to it saying, you know, your work matters, and you're teaching my heart to breathe. And it as a poet, for me, the circle is complete with audience. I you know, my dogs they wag their tails when I read my poems to them, but I'd rather, and in fact, my poems aside, if I had the opportunity, I'd belly fill cargo planes with the poems my young ones have written and drop them in a confetti storm across in cities all over the
world.
Could change the world. And speaking of which, could I hit you with a couple more
Please.
Short poems? Helena Marcus, when she was 4. Inside each snowflake, there is a waterfall where God is taking a bath.
We'll never get that good.
No.
Give us another.
I had this boy, I had this group of second graders placed up inside a tree, and they were basing their responses in the literal world. And then I said, what if it was a magical tree? Every hand shot up into the sky. The daddy lions are driving their motorcycles along the branches. The mommy lions are using the leaves like spatulas to flip their hamburgers. This Providence would have it. My hand is guided to this one boy who says, in this magical zoo kingdom in a tree, the elephants are 8,000 feet wide, and they're swinging from a rope 8,000 feet long for the rest of our lives.
Was it really intact like that?
It poured from his mouth like sacred
For
text.
The rest of our lives. What that means is that you planted a seed in him for the rest of his life.
Well... I really think in learning the world, one of the first things I write on the board in any class I teach is unlearn. Unlearn moon. So, you know, Frost says the moon is one luminary clock against the sky. Frank Stanford says it's a dead man floating down the river. Jack Gilbert says, I say moon is horse in the tempered dark because horse is as close as I can get to it. And they revolutionize or torque our sense of the ordinary. And so we see with these radically new eyes. So the young ones still don't have nailed down in their sensibility what moon and brick and star and mud are. And, you know, I know the hormones hit eventually. Sixth grade's a big transition point. And they become self-conscious and other things are happening. But the young ones are still willing to take an ordinary object in their hands and allow for some sort of combustion to happen. Mm-hmm. It's not the objects in the ordinary world. It's the way the light of the imagination hits them that gives them their power.
So you don't say, you know, what is invention in poetry? I mean, you don't say, how do we invent? Poetry is invention for you.
Oh, yeah. I'll get them doing it. I'll say, let's do something with moon. At night, my father latches a hold of the moon like a loaf of stale bread. He crushes it in his fingers and sprinkles the breadcrumbs across the rooftops of the city. One kid I had at a juvenile lockup said when he was growing up, he thought of the sidewalk as a drawer you could open. I was blind, but now I see. It revolutionizes the way we look at an ordinary object.
Especially the word open in his condition.
Yes.
A slate of concrete, a piece of concrete that can open, a drawer that can open. And that would have come out of his psyche at that time.
Yeah.
Being closed in.
Right.
So there's a lot going on.
And the quest for the adult writers is to reclaim some of that, you know, wild imagining and re-envisioning. And there's a deluge of great writers in the language that do it.
Who?
Charles Simic is a sentence.
Yeah.
He's a maestro of transformation.
Mm-hmm. If you were to say, are you like anyone? You're not really like any poet I can think of. There's no school for you. You need to go to school.
Well, it's interesting because I do have a penchant for compression and melody and, you know, the ringing of acoustical bells in the
it's
sentence.
It's more like the metaphysics.
It
really is. You're just in the wrong century, John.
You
just dropped by. Let's hear a poem.
Okay, I'm gonna shift to the workplace and...
The tire shop.
The tire shop
okay.
poem. I don't even know what to say.
Well, tell us why you worked there, first of all.
Well, it's the antithesis of my creative life. I'm always banging my head against the heavens, grabbing onto God's flaming beard, you know, to do something where you're kneeling down and slop and you're, you know, gunning lug nuts on and off and, you know, rolling rubber up and down your calf, and you get this rhythm where you become this kind of this ballet, this rugged rough ballet. You master every movement and you dance around with these other rugged boys, and
It's the other side.
It's a respite from fire. It's a welcome respite from the creative fire. Tire shop poem. What we're all doing is dancing, gliding under the undercarriage of this car, our hands trenched with oil and winter slop that stings down the neckline of my shirt, teeth in my pocket because it's Christmas time and there are Fannie Mae chocolates on the front counter. Try and stop the flesh and it wiggles out from inside your gloves and smashes itself against hubcaps and rubber, Cooper Cobras and tiger paws, those snare drum skins we slap, tire after tire, just to listen to something solid ringing back. I catch this Adam Upstart go red hot, beat the clang of pry bar to rim, swivel the deck and hiss of air he might with his own breath be lips to each valve stem, blowing these tires up so he can lie down at night with so many people riding on his breath over snow, riding on his breath over leaves. I catch his dare and rubber roll a tire up my calf and pop the center cap, clamp and spin, hammer lead weights onto rim after dizzying rim. I lug nuck smash and flick the pry bar from one hand to the next, Fred Astaire in a tire shop, where we slap our boots across all that slop to outdistance fire, outdistance that burning bush that follows us everywhere.
We should say that this ethereal poet, John Rybicki, is also a very physical person and plays ice hockey in his gladiator suit and runs every day and swims every day and thumps the table while he's talking because he has this, he calls himself a hurricane of energy. And you just have to keep channeling it, right? And roping it and harnessing it, netting it in. So you have
You should write that down, Grace.
Okay. Taste of my own medicine. So you have all these facets to your personality, and they all show up on the page. I mean, it's a very energetic writing. Your writing is a very energetic writing. It couldn't come from someone who could not move through the world physically at all. John Rybicki is the guy I'm talking about, and you offered to mow my lawn. Did you remember that?
I would mow your lawn. I'll park out with a sleeping bag. I'll mow your lawn.
Thank you. We're not going to take you up on it, but it was just so sweet of you. It was the first poet I ever had make such an offer. But I want to hear a little more poem. And we'll have one more poem and then get ready for our final poem.
Okay. We're going to...
This is another book.
Yeah, this is from Traveling at High Speeds. I lived on a dairy farm in grad school, and if the city boy in me could have sprouted a puppy dog tail, that tail was flopping radical all the time, just to be a brick-born boy in collision with this new world. I got to climb inside an empty silo and kneel and sing, and the acoustics were just, my voice was reverberating up into the heavens. I'd go in at night and, feed these calves their milk, and they'd tug at my fingers, mm-hmm. trying to tug milk out. They'd tug at the buttons on my coat. We also had a trial Guernsey sire, T.H. Hickory, and I was living with an 82-year-old dairyman, and he showed me the printout of the top bull sires in the land, and the top dog bull had fathered 15,000 children. And I was like, man, he must have a hard time sleeping at night after all that. But T.H. Hickory was still on trial. They didn't know if his semen was going to produce good, engender good milk cows that kicked out a lot of milk volume. Ornery bull cows. I'd go into the barn. He'd start banging his head against the wall. Stay away from my women, And I also based this poem on a sense of they'd pen him up away from all the cows a lot of the time. And he was so isolated and solitary. And I thought, what if I was a guy that close to so many women and I couldn't get to them? So there's a poem about that. T.H. Hickory, trial Guernsey sire on the Breeders' Exchange. He'd stand there banging his stone head against the guardrail between us, great funnels of mist pouring from his snout. I'd pass by him until he swung broadside, lifting and planting his hooves in the mud. Then I'd scratch his dusty hide, making him bow, huge and sedate, his muscles twitching as if jerking off flies. Sure, he could ram my coat buttons through my ribs or pin me to the swivel rail, but 10 dozen herds tick in his groin, and all day the milkers swing past, flopping in their giant breasts.
John Rebicki, let's have a final poem.
Okay, this is called Seals Up All in Rust, and it's from my next collection, and Grace edited it en route to the studio today, so I'm going to read her revised version.
Maybe we could give them both of them and see who's right.
Yeah, I'll do a little vote across the airwaves. All right, Seals Up All in Rust, Grace's version. Heart blown up so many times, my skin hates my bones for forcing it to stand, for not allowing the flesh to just fall steaming to the earth. Lie down now. Let me lie down on the grass in empty out, Lord. Let my heart rest under one leaf, pressing like my love's hand once did, as if a heart could lunge right off the cupboard shelf and float around the yard. Leave a house like hers alone in this world with so many losses like playing cards made of flame sliding to every edge of the compass. I am too tired for translation. Take away my bones, Lord. Let my skin fall through the bed springs, through the floorboards. I'll make so small a splash.
Okay, now, he had two other lines before I got to him. So let's hear those two lines.
All right, and I'll just read like a couple stanzas before to set it up. I am too tired for translation. Take away my bones, Lord. Let my skin fall through the bed springs, through the floorboards. I'll make so small a splash against the sweet grass, and then I'll rest.
I like to end with splash. That was the voice of John Rebicki. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Thanks also to The Wordworks, presenting poetry programs in Washington, D.C. since 1977, and acknowledgement to Avide Shoshani and Ken McNeil for their support. Our associate producer is Ken Flynn, our assistant producer Maria Van Buren, our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.